Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. I'm Billy Allen.
I'm Niels Nielsen, and today we have one of the best coaches in the business, and you've probably never heard of him. That was my experience, at least, when I got a chance to work for him in 2015 on staff with the Pan American Games in Mexico. That was also the question Billy and John asked when I suggested him for the show. Let me read a quick rundown of what this coach has been up to. Most recently, he finished his 20th year as head coach for the men's program at Springfield College. He finished that year with his 10th Division III national championship. In 2015, he received the USA Volleyball All-Time Great Coach Award in the Contemporary Division. He's been named National Coach of the Year two times in his 20-year career. He's coached a very young and inexperienced USA team to a silver medal in the Pan American Cup in Mexico, and went to the most recently went to the Olympics with the team in Rio as one of the coach consultants. I also found a quote which I thought summed up an amazing coaching philosophy, which I will read now. Quote, "I love that you can teach a player how to improve as a volleyball player and as a person at the same time. Inside the volleyball lines is a micro society that has many challenges and struggles that are involved in life. To practice these skills in a volleyball setting and use similar strategies in life is what makes coaching volleyball at Springfield College special for me." Charlie Sullivan, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, guys. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely. So I'm not 100% sure all those statistics were correct. Are there any corrections that need to be made?
No, they were fine. They were good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So the topic today is game time talks, but before we get into our topic of the day, I did want one confirmation on a story that I heard, and you have to let me know if this is true. Is it true that your volleyball coaching career started with a coin flip?
Yeah, this is true. It got out at the USA banquet a couple years ago when I got the all-time greatest coach award, and Bill Kaufman caught it, and then it's gone. Everyone kind of knows about it now. But I went overseas to try to play soccer. I was in England. And I ran out of money in like 3 days. I was going to plan on staying there all fall from like July to December. And so I went to this school and said, can I cut the lawn or something? They said no. And but we have a sister school in Rome, Italy that has a position, AD, coach, phys ed teacher. And I was a phys ed undergrad at Springfield College. And I said, I really want to do it, but I'll check it out. So I went to Rome and they offered me the job. I said, I would take it to December because I plan on playing soccer with a pro team in January. But the first thing they had in that fall at that school in Rome, Italy, was an international school, was they had no boys volleyball coach. The school had previously been all girls. It was going quite for the first year. So the headmistress said, it's really important that one of you two guys coach the team and do a good job and start to build the boys program up here so we get more male athletes attracted to coming to school here. And I walked out of the office and I just said to the other guy, listen, I've never seen volleyball. I've never played it. I've never seen a game. I've no idea. There's no way I'm doing that with that huge responsibility. He kind of said the same thing. And after a little while, we figured the only way we could settle it was a coin toss, which I lost, and my career started. So it's pretty funny. So Rita Crockett played in Rome at the time from Messaggero, and her daughter was in my third grade class. And so I just, I had a parent-teacher conference within the first 2 days of school and said, Rita, you need to help me. I have no idea what's going on. I'm supposed to coach this team, and I had never seen volleyball. So she was really cool spending time with me. I went from our practices over to the Messaggero practices where she played, and I kind of hung around for some of the men's practices too. So I felt like I was kind of brought into this sport at a really high level in terms of, at that time, the Italian league was probably the best league in the world. They played the players the most, and it was just an amazing experience. I kind of morphed into those staffs and kind of was a volunteer assistant for those staffs. So I went pretty deep in right away, and I ended up not playing soccer. So most of my competitive juices, I've never not played a sport in my life, went into learning this game, and I fell in love with the team concept of the game, the momentum, and I fell in love with coaching. So it all happened all at once. It was a pretty cool experience.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, the quote that I sound or the story that I saw, it didn't say whether you lost or you won the coin toss. So I was curious what happened there.
A good loss. A good loss. That
makes a better story maybe that you lost.
Yeah. Really fortunate. Just a really good life decision I didn't make. That's kind of like my life story. So
Yeah. Well, I love it. So, okay, let's get into the topic today. And basically, this came out of, you know, as volleyball coaches, we have a lot of time and space to influence the players during the actual play of a match, with between the sets and with all the timeouts that happen. So I know it's important to be prepared to say the right things at the right times. And for the majority of my career, those times were always just completely winging it. I had no real idea of structure or anything like that. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about how you approach these times with your teams.
I think the key word you mentioned there is influential. I think, the word that directly correlates with leadership for me is influential. So if I have a chance to influence a player, that's a really important opportunity for me. And I think the other I word is informative. So just by giving really solid, concrete information and influencing players positively is what you would try to probably prepare for when you're talking about just winging it. But so those things are really important for me, to just be influential and informative to help our guys get to their potential.
Awesome. And I guess just starting with before the match and a pregame speech, what goes into that? What makes a good pregame speech in your mind? And maybe can you take us an example of a speech you've given or what it sounds like in your locker room?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it only has to do with pregame speeches. We have like themes we go over before practice or if something's going on that we need to learn. We have a kind of an approach to doing that, maybe a speech before practice. And so I think they're kind of thematic and I think they're good stories. And I think a story is really important because it really captures someone's heart. And then after you have their heart, you can give them some good information to be informative and influential. So I don't know, it's maybe one that sticks out. I was just talking to an alum the other day and he told me about the peanut butter and jelly one was pretty good. And we were playing kind of too many errors and trying to do too many crazy things at some point. And I think I just got the guys in the classroom before the game. I put peanut butter on a piece of bread, jelly on another, and put it together. And I was like, that's just a damn good sandwich. And tastes really good. It's nutritious. It's filling. And that's so simple. So just the theme that day was just being simple, just like a good peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So, I think just themes like that just help us maybe influence our guys and get them in the right frame of mind. So that was one. That's just one example. A guy I was talking about the other day with me, which was kind of funny.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Maybe you talk about stories and themes. Can you give us maybe a couple of examples more that you've used in your practices that have came up in matches?
Well, another simple theme I did once I thought was pretty funny. We had this guy who was just taking, bad decisions and making a bad play worse by airing out. And he's kind of a really good player, really flashy, had those new Nike sneakers on that were so cool. And I was saying that play you tried to make was really, really, that was like really sexy. That was really like creative and God, it was phenomenal. It was like a Ferrari. And so the gym was, we were in the back gym that day and the door out of the back gym, my minivan was parked there. And so I had my keys. I said, hey man, I want you to get in the van and drive around the parking lot a couple times. And he's like, what? I was like, yeah, just get in my minivan and drive around the parking lot a couple times, see how it feels. And he came back and was like, did it feel sexy? Did you feel like that was like flashy? And I was like, when you drive a minivan, bro, you get no looks. There's like nothing flashy about it. It is not attractive to anybody. It's just a simple car that gets a good result. So that's kind of how I want you to feel when you're in that situation making decisions. And so maybe I would go back in the games and they'll be like, hey, remember the minivan? This was kind of we need the minivan in that situation, not the Ferrari. So maybe just a theme like that could carry over to a match and give a quick reminder to influence them to be a little better.
Is that something you came up with on the fly, or is that something that just
kind of the fly? Yeah, I was just trying to think of something right there. I don't know if a lot of my themes are. Well, I think some are premeditated for sure, but that day was on the fly, and that stuck with him for a while, which is pretty cool. So,
maybe I'm always curious to hear like the opposite as well. So, can you think of any like the worst speeches or timeout or pre-game speeches you've ever given?
Well, I would think I'd probably know right away if it wasn't effective. I didn't feel like I had an influence on the group a little bit, and by the way, on a side topic, I think the research has proven that pregame speeches are really not effective in terms of having a statistical difference on an athlete or team. But I don't agree with that, and I think that's what was so cool about that time in Italy when I first started coaching volleyball, because as an athlete, I prepared myself pretty well, I felt. But now I was responsible for preparing a group, maybe 18 guys, to be really good and girls to be really good. And for a group to be on the same page, that was a lot more difficult than for me to just get me at a good spot. So I was really attracted to the influence in a group and having a large amount of people be great together. And I think that's kind of why I kind of get into these themes or these pregame speeches, and I enjoy them so much because I think that I can have a positive influence and be informed, help a team, help a group get to a high level play. So, but if I have a pregame speech or I have a theme story that goes on, and I can tell right away if I'm upset that it wasn't so influential. And you know, maybe in Division III volleyball, we play some doubleheaders sometimes. You play a match, and then you play another match right after that. So, like, the home team will play first Team C, then we'll be Team B, we'll play Team C, and the home team will play us right after that. So they have a nice rest, they're hanging out, and you got to just win the match, get organized, and it's always tough to kind of get some kind of nourishment, kind of review the next scout report, and then get into the match. And pregame speeches are tough there. So I can remember a tournament we were at, we were kind of back-to-back matches like that. And I knew right away after I talked to the guys when we were scouting for it, gave them a little theme that wasn't good, and we ended up getting smoked pretty good. So I think right away I had a feeling that I was not so influential. And, you know, maybe sometimes that they're distracted and they're not in a good spot, but I have a chance to get them back on track and get them back focused. So I can remember that match not being really satisfied pregame, and it just got worse and worse and worse. So,
do you remember what the theme was?
You know, I just remember it didn't have a great content to it. You know, it didn't have a creative content. I think maybe they were used to, my themes probably have some creative content to them that gives a good story, and it gives a good, you know, they listen to it and I get their heart and then I give some information. So I just remember that team that probably. Probably was my lack of energy that didn't give a good creative content to what I was saying. So I have a tough time. I struggle with those back-to-back matches in terms of I think I put a lot into a match and still not used to having put a lot into a match and then sit down and turn my head and get right back into another match and kind of reboot. So that's difficult at the Division III level. So I think that was probably a lack of creative energy at that point. So. My Hagendoff story is a good one too. We had to make the play simple as well. It gives me another simple memory is that I had in the classroom before our practice a little container of vanilla bean Hagendoff ice cream. And it's like my favorite ice cream because it's just simple and good. And I went on the website and I tried to show all the guys the variety of flavors of Hagendoff, like they had cherry Garcia, peanut butter, Ripple Cow, all these different names. They're trying so hard to make this great ice cream, but the real ice cream that's the best is Häagen-Dazs vanilla. So we often talk about Häagen-Dazs vanilla ice cream, our vanilla bean ice cream, how good it is. Our program is just to keep the play simple and make a good play. And I know this national championship, we had one rally that was pretty influential in the match that I think there was three or four swings where our guys just went up. They just didn't get their shoulder behind the ball, so they kept the ball in simply, put it in a good spot. And then we, our block and B had a chance to win it, and we won it like the fourth time across. So I think that was an example of peanut butter and jelly, Häagen-Dazs, and then you get an effect.
I love it. So, I mean, you're talking about like the peanut butter jelly, a minivan versus a Ferrari and a vanilla bean, and you do that in a creative way, but that all kind of goes in the idea of what you were saying, where it's simple, right? Play simple, effective volleyball. I guess the question that I would have was what other kind of informational things that are like that are continually coming up? So as you create these themes and these stories, what information are you trying to get across to the guys? One would be simple. What are some other ones?
Before we get into that, can I just get a little bit more example on what you mean by playing simple? I know you meant like out of system, kind of just snapping a ball in, not risking it. Does it have to do with kind of how you run your offense? Like what is a good, simple strategy for you guys?
No, it has more to do with risk management. really, and you know, just decreasing errors. I mean, yeah, I think statistically, if we have less than 8 errors a game, we win it 95% of the time. So just an opportunity to keep the ball in play and kind of analyze the situation really good and know when to go for it and know when not to go for it.
Cool. And is that, I guess, how does that factor into your guys' serving strategy? Is that something you guys try to limit errors on a lot? Or?
You know, this year our serving philosophy is fairly aggressive, where we had 5 guys back there that were trying to get 3 or 4 points in a row. And when we had matches where we erred, and they didn't really happen a lot this year until late in the season, in the quarterfinal we had 15 aces and 16 errors in the quarterfinal match in the NCAA tournament. So that was a match where we were erring a little bit, and maybe 5's a little high, but we were still getting a lot of good aces out of it. So, but I think to manage that aspect of it, it's more about focusing very specifically and just being good at what you do by yourself, which is serving. So in that regard, it's not so much backing off. It's more about being aggressive and being kind of a controlled, aggressive focus back there.
Cool.
So then maybe we could go back and you could give us some more things that you talk about where one was simple and what are some other informations that you're trying to get to the guys?
Yeah, it might be, something to do with cohesion or how we're working together. It could be like you started out with, it's an opportunity for us to have to learn a skill that's going to help us play better, that's going to be transferable into life, so like a life skill. So, we've had a team roster the last 2 or 3 years that's had 6 or 7 guys from Puerto Rico, so that's been a constant new initiative, how to teach a team that's divided culturally. So that's been a whole, there's been a lot of themes around kind of relating to each other and working together and being a great cohesive unit.
I like it. Life skills.
Cool. I just have a question. I know you mentioned like maybe some studies are saying one thing. Maybe you've in your experience you felt kind of another. I guess, do you think players need to be inspired to play their best? And how do you sustain that through a whole season with, I guess, just the grind of a season?
Yeah, I think that's where I think the creative energy comes in. That's something I've maybe done really well in terms of having a new angle, a new twist. So when April started this year, because our championships last week in April, we kind of had our themes we put up in the locker room, bulletin board when the guys went in the locker room. So I do think that, I don't know if they need to be inspired to play their best, really, but I really enjoy inspiring them to play their best. That's something I really found fascinating about coaching. And so, it influenced them positively by giving them different creative themes that's going to help them play better or get an idea of information that's going to help them play better. I think that's fun. And it isn't easy to come up with. And maybe that's where I was kind of giving an example when I suffered a little bit at that doubleheader match. It's not always easy to come up with. I think maybe I'm passionate about what I'm doing, so that comes out of me pretty easily, so or easier. But some themes I would use a trick like that, and maybe I wouldn't use it again for another 4 years. So I would hold off knowing that I didn't want to repeat. But I have some in the bank too, which is kind of cool.
Right. Yeah, it's like, cool. It's cool that it stayed with that player all those years after. It seems like a lot of those themes might stick and those imagery.
Yeah, that's really cool. That makes it all worth it. So it's fun.
I have an example of one of the pregame speeches that you gave when I was coaching for you. And it was when we were going into the finals versus Cuba at the Pan Am Cup. And for my entire career, in every final or playoff or elimination game that I had ever played in, you listen to the coach beforehand. And the idea was always, this is just another game. Do the things that got you here and we're going to be fine. And you go into that locker room, guys' attention is on you, and the first thing you said was, this is not like the rest of the games. And immediately I was like, wait, what? And it blew my mind. I know the guys clicked in. Maybe they had heard it. But then you went on to acknowledge the fact that this was special. This was something that was different than the rest. And the idea was to acknowledge that And after acknowledging that, take that power away and then go back to doing the same kind of things that got you there.
Yeah.
But the simple act of acknowledging it was the idea that you wouldn't panic or you, this is special, and let that go and now go back to what you normally do. It was just a different framing of it, and that stuck with me a lot. I've used that same framing with my guys and girls in elimination games. I don't know how it worked for them, but I remember that as a very specific example for me that stuck with me, and it was really fun to take that away from the tournament.
I remember that, and I think the point of that was it has a lot to do with the personality of the group too. Like, that might have worked with that team that we actually lost, so maybe it didn't work. Cuba was pretty good that day. Their lefty was hitting over our guys pretty good. But, that it happens to maybe with the personality of our group. I thought our group was a group that Pan American Cup, that a young team that bonded really well together cohesively and that have shown really good aggressive play. And so the purpose of that was to get a really aggressive final out of them. Because Cuba's national team. We were just younger players, a lot of college players. And I just wanted I knew if our guys were going to be great, we had to play A+. I wanted them to be aggressive, and I felt that their personalities had shown tendencies to be aggressive in that tournament. So I just wanted to click on that a little more aggressive tendency for them and get that out of them. And then, like you're saying, go back to the strategy of how we're going to defend the lefty opposite, what we're going to do versus the middles and their distribution, things like that. So I think that a lot of it has to do with the personality of the group. Like, anytime you motivate someone, you don't have to know their personality first before you know what buttons are going to make them go, what buttons you can push to make them go. So, I had double dip with that. And that had been a method I used with a really aggressive group I had at Springfield before one of our finals, and they were really aggressive and kind of just, I don't think anyone's ever won a championship casually, so I think they were pretty aggressive about taking what was theirs that day and winning the championship. So I used that before, and that was kind of a double dip in that instance. So that's pretty cool.
Cool. And you mentioned talking about the strategy against Cuba. What kind of technical information or scouting do you give before a game, and how do you find a balance and giving good information but not like overwhelming the players?
Yeah, I think scouting reports is a skill. And so our freshmen probably come into our program a little overwhelmed with the amount of information they're getting. But by the time they're a senior, they can get the same amount of information and process it really quickly. So we like to teach our guys how to process information because we want to give them more rather than less. And I think that's one of the things when I enjoy coaching and get a group ready. I think it builds my credibility when I give them a report and those things come true. I think it builds my credibility when I talk about themes that are going to make them better and those things come true. And it becomes cyclical positively that we can really all get on the same page and a really strong level of trust, and just keeps on going up and up. If it keeps on going in a good way and it's positive, then we just get stronger and stronger as a group. So if I gave them a scout report the day before, and we have in our league, we hit for five, then we're off for five. Those 5 minutes we're off, we're reviewing scout report information like, hey, zone four, remember to take that guy across, but his D ball's line, and zone two, we need you to lock down the line, and we're gonna be shallow five, and just go through some positional stuff that we have to be remembering to be really good at the match next to you at a high level. So some things particular to the team. So I think when you get those things right, I think when you have, yes, before Billy Fitz, players need to be inspired, but I think when you do inspire and it works, and these things that are coming true in the matches, that just helps a coach's credibility a lot. So we spend a lot of time scouting reports. We spend a lot of time being right, and we spend a lot of time getting the guys' trust.
Cool, I like that. Spend a lot of time being right. But you said by the time they're senior year, they're kind of like able to take in and process a lot more. Is there a process for that, or they just kind of get used to it kind of throughout their years on their own, or do you sit down and I don't know, how do you get them to that point?
Well, sometimes the older players will help them, the freshmen, the younger guys with a report. They'll see it. Like I love going down to the bench and talking to the bench about, hey, we said we're going to block the line of the D ball, and that was like 6 feet open. You can see how that's not how we're not really being successful there. So in that regard, sometimes I would meet with the players extra if I see they don't know the scout report, because I can do a scout report review where I can ask the players questions, or I can tell them I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to call on a player, and if a player's getting the answer incorrect, often then we'll have to spend some more time and make sure he knows how to process the scout report. So. But I do think it's a skill that they just get better and better at knowing what different situations they're going to be responsible for and all the things that you're responsible for. And kind of like some teams have a set that's really live, so they know what to do versus a set that's live. And they know what to do versus a set that's not live. So they just get better at processing information. Like I said, it's just like a skill that they have to get some ideas fundamentally how to perform really well, and then they just get more polished out as they go along. Nils, I think I don't know if you were there in the tournament at the Pan Am Cup, but we played like Puerto Rico the third match, and we were in the back gym, the auxiliary gym, you know.
Yeah.
And we've had success in the first couple of matches unexpectedly, and we were undefeated. We were going in, and the guys were in the back gym, and that's kind of like the third week of training where maybe guys are getting a little fatigued about you know, being at the grind for that long. And our guys were warming up real casually, I think, like Brinkley and can't remember his name right now. But the guys were just chilling out, not doing nothing too intense. And I said to the trainer, I said, yeah, it's a bummer. I just feel like they're not really focused right now. They're not really into this moment right now. And I hate to see them just go out and lay an egg and waste what they're doing so far in the tournament. They played so well. And the trainer, you know what the trainer said? He said, I can't tell you the number of times a coach has said to me after the match, I wish I had said something before the match. Just like I was saying, the coach noticed something that wasn't right, but didn't intervene and kind of let it go. And so we went to behind the auxiliary gym in that little patio section there. And I said something. He's like, I should be honest with you. It doesn't look like you're really into this right now in terms of preparing to be at your potential during the match. I mean, two guys are having a frappuccino in the corner. Other guys are juggling a soccer ball. Maybe two guys are playing short court. And we're not going through our regular warm-up. We're not hitting our routine. And, you know, I'm here just to be an advocate of you. I'm here just to support you. But I can tell you that it doesn't seem like you're at your best right now in terms of preparation. And I remember we went back in and we played well. And I went up to the trainer. I forgot the trainer's name. He was a real good guy. But I said, man, you saved the day, right? We're still undefeated because of you. And the guys did get back on track. The warm-up was a little different after that, and that was pretty cool. And I don't know if you were out there, Nils. I think you might have been doing something or getting ready for the match and something else. But I remember that was that during that tournament, that was pretty cool for me to hear. I remember.
Yeah, that's great.
Nils was fixing his hair.
No, you probably had 14 other things to do. So.
Yeah, you kept me pretty busy. It was a great learning experience for sure.
It was an awesome time.
I got to hang out with Sam while he did that video up in the stands.
Oh, man.
So I kind of want to dive into timeouts now and see what your thoughts are on timeouts, because there's definitely a different dynamic from before the game when you're actually in it. So let me start with just throw out some philosophy on why you would call a timeout.
Well, the other team's scoring a lot more than us. I don't like to go down early. You know, I like early timeouts, you know, 5-1, 4-1, I'm interested. 5-1, I'm probably calling 6-2-ish. I feel if I call timeouts early and we get back into the game, in the middle of the game, then at the end of the game, the other team's going to give me two more timeouts. So to hold our timeout at 6-1 and hold it till it's like 15-something where the game's maybe out of reach at that time, that we're not going to get everyone's timeouts on the table. So I think I like calling early timeouts to get our guys going again. And I also like it because I think that if we come back in the middle of the game, later in the game, we're going to get their timeouts too. So we get more time to go over things together. So, you know, so I kind of like them early for sure.
Okay. So early and then scoring runs. Would there ever be a reason, or are there any key triggers that you're looking for other than those point runs? That would make you call a timeout?
Yeah, I think some more quicker timeouts are when it's just we're not doing what we talked about. We're not executing at our level, or we're just totally, you know, messing up some of the tactical approaches that we're going to use in the game, or strategic approaches that they're not executing. So we just want to make sure we can change that as soon as possible. So.
And I guess how would a timeout be different at the end of the game when, let's say, you're on the scoring run and you're saying you're using their timeout to your advantage? Like, what goes into that conversation at that point?
Yeah, we had a timeout in the championship this year. And we at that point, we're probably just seeing what they're doing. We're gonna serve into them what their side out's going to be and set up our block and D and give our guys an idea of the probable distribution. So our assistant called them on X2 and their typical team that would go into a timeout and come out with something different or some one time thing. And geez, I didn't jump on it. We didn't tell the guys, and they ran X2, and I was like, dang, that was a good call. I should have been on that too, you know. But so at that point, if we're leading, they're calling timeout, we're kind of setting up our block and D for the next rotation and see what's going on.
Would you ever call a timeout and kind of try to re-inspire the guys?
Yeah, that's where I could hit like on a theme that could, you know, trigger a memory of something like the minivan or the Haagen-Dazs vanilla bean or something like that. Yeah, we can go back to that for sure.
So I'm always curious. This is the first time I ever heard somebody having a structure to their timeout speeches, mm-hmm. if you will. Was Sue Inquist. She was a softball coach at UCLA. Mm-hmm. She pretty good. She gave a speech and she kind of broke it down into four parts. Where if things weren't going well, she'd bring the team in, and one, she would acknowledge whatever situation they were in. The second part is she would tell a story of the team or a player having past success in a similar situation that they were in now. And then she would ground the player or the team in an actionable present moment thing that they could do or focus on. And then she would send them off predicting future success with that actionable task if they stay focused. And that to me was just an amazing breakdown to think about it in those terms. Yeah. Is there anything that you've ever had or experienced that's similar to that?
Yeah, sounds cool. I wouldn't say I have that structure around my timeouts, but I do try to stay positive and positive specific, like, and using names like Billy. That was an awesome job in zone 4 when they set that D ball out of nowhere and you just stole the line. You didn't let that guy go down the line, and we got him coming back in the court. That's the kind of things that are letting our team know that you're in a great spot today, and it's really helpful. So I think positive specific and using names is really cool. I try to do that a lot. Especially if the guys are playing well and getting it done. But other than that, we're kind of maybe reviewing our scout report a little bit, or going over what they're doing a little bit. They might be making some changes or something. We have an assistant that's checking in with the setter, make sure they're on the same plan for the offensive plan, and then going over again future rotations that are coming up. I think every time I look at our data volley guy, and he puts up a number where we are in rotation. So if I don't know where we are, he lets me know. So what the other team's in rotation wise, so we can prepare for what's coming down the line for our block and D.
Oh, so they tend to be a little more tactics based.
Yeah. So, I guess that, yeah, I do like, I think the positive specific, I think, you know, just there's nothing wrong with telling you guys are great and they're doing great. And I don't think I don't think we do that as enough as coaches. So if I can give a positive specific that went on and give an example, I think that and I show the team, like when Mills serves like that, we know because he's controlling that serve that he's ready to go tonight. That's very influential. That's very leadership like for him. So it helps our team play at a high level.
So what are you thinking when you look across and you see the other coach just laying into his guys and being negative? That's just an advantage for you guys.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's really cool. You see first that before the timeout, the coach is like, you know, putting his head in his hands and maybe stamping his foot. Like that anger over there is a really good thing for us. It's a good sign.
How? What strategy? This is a tangent question. What strategies do you use to make sure that you, as the coach, are not on the emotional roller coaster that the team is on?
Yeah. There's intelligence, IQ. There's social intelligence. There's emotional intelligence. That's a really important part of coaching. Just staying really consistent. I think the best thing you can offer a relationship is consistency. So if I'm consistently the same emotionally all the time, whether we're up or down, and that's really comforting for the guys. And that makes them feel like, hey, we're down 6-2, but, you know, we can get a couple and side out. We can be, you know, within two, and then it's anybody's game. So just working on being consistent all the time, Nils.
And during these timeouts, what's the player's role? Do they give any feedback, or are they just supposed to, like, rest, get some water, and be attentive? What do you want them to be doing?
That's actually a good question, because I do ask them. Sometimes, like, I'll say the service here, is that guy doing anything different than we saw in the video yesterday, or are we prepared for in the scout report? And he could say, yeah, he's coming more to five or to a new spot, or he could say, no, it's the same. And I'll just question them about things that they're seeing out there that I might not be seeing. Or I can even ask the bench sometimes too, is that guy going line on that D-ball? Is he coming across now? So, their role is really to be at their best, to influence others to be at their best as well. And then if I have some questions for them, I can ask them some specific questions too about exactly what's going on out there, if we need to change anything, or is it going as planned.
And what would you want your assistant to be doing during a timeout? Do you ever risk letting Niels talk? Or
yeah, it's probably a little too controlling, Niels. I'll apologize now for that. But it depends on the role of the assistant. We've had some assistants that have been very strong in terms of their role. And maybe like one guy was I get a new assistant every 2 years with our graduate program. He gets a grad degree and his tuition reimbursement is working with our team. And so it's not easy because every 2 years there's a kind of a new personality, a new role in there. So I find I probably do a little too much, but a couple of those guys have been really strong about researching the offense, scouting the offense, and running our offense and being communicated with our setter. So it just depends on that particular person in our program. But a guy that's been more involved will get more in there in the timeouts. Definitely between games. I mean, I need a couple minutes or a minute and a half at least to do this, to match ups and get in the next rotations ready, so or see where we're going to start. So at that time, they have a good minute and a half to be with the guys and kind of review. So before the end of the game, I might say, hey, between games, talk to them about that D ball. We're not blocking it line. We need to take it more line. So stuff like that.
How has your talks in between sets and in timeouts, how has that changed over time?
I have to talk slower because I have guys from Puerto Rico that don't understand me at all. So I talk a lot slower. I've become a very boring coach, I feel, because I don't have as much speed and tempo in my talk. I'm probably talking too fast right now. But I don't think they've changed that much. I would think, and Nils, maybe you can attest, that I probably give more information in timeouts than other coaches do. So when I've gone like a high performance championship and hung out with my friends and we listen to each other's timeouts, the kind of common feedback is that you give a ton of information. And but I don't think they've really changed that much. They're kind of going back on those same themes, like positive specific, checking in on the scout reports and tactics, some future things that we're going to see in terms of what role they're in, and then maybe addressing some questions for the guys.
You kind of touched on some of the things you're trying to do actively during your timeout, being positive, specific, and using names. Other than maybe anger, is there anything that you try to make sure you avoid in timeouts or between sets?
I don't want to be negative, and I don't want to tell them what they're doing wrong or how they're not playing well. I just want to be positive and optimistic and give them hope for the future, which is really cool. And then, I don't do a lot of technical information. I think their game is their game that day, and they have to be able to trust it. So if I'm trying to change their footwork or change their arm swing or change something technically, then I'm essentially saying that I'm not trusting what they're doing. So I'm more just changing them, if they're not playing well, how they're feeling and how they're thinking, as our feelings are just a pure barometer of our thoughts. So the technical stuff's a little dangerous. I've coached with John Sproul on the national team, and he is even – more hardcore about not doing anything technical. Like when we were playing one match, I was like, we just passed the ball a little higher, our offense being a better tempo, and he didn't want to go there at all. Like, that's way too technical. I think even changing your platform angle was too technical for him. So I'm probably not as stingy as that about not addressing anything technical, but I certainly don't want to change their game right there. I don't want to teach them how to play volleyball. If they don't want to play volleyball at that point, then I haven't done a good job in practice with them. So...
right. So let's say they're a player you've been working on a technique in practice, and you guys, he hasn't quite got it yet. I guess what's your talk going into the game? They're just going to try it out, and you're not going to give them any feedback on that. Or are you just going to, like, I don't know if they're reverting back to something?
Mm. Yeah, I would think before that, I would catch them doing it right and be like, "Man, your footwork was awesome. You see that result? Isn't that fun? Like, that's awesome." Mm-hmm. Like, you worked on that so hard, and you did the footwork right, and look what just happened right there. And even maybe we didn't win the rally, but I knew they could just point out that he did it well in the match to give him confidence with that and make him feel better. But if you're reverting back, then that's actually that's a little bit more evidence for me. I might have to sub out of that time and I go back to the video. And I was like, look, here it is. When your footwork's like that, we're really not getting the results we need and you're not at your potential. So here's what we're gonna do today. We're gonna work on a little more. We're gonna come in before practice or stay after practice and spend some 10, 15 minutes doing it the right way so you can get it down and we can have some success with it. So, but I still wouldn't be too heavy. I might touch on it a little bit, but not too much. Really, I wouldn't really want to harp on a technique so much during a match.
So what is, we're going to go with both. Well, let's start with the best timeout story that you've ever given.
Yeah. So, it was like my third or fourth year at Springfield. And we hadn't won a national championship yet. And I wasn't sure we could win a national championship. Our NYU and Juniata were the main Division III teams on East Coast then. I thought they had better recruiting pools and resources than we did. And there was UC San Diego and Laverne out there on the West Coast. I don't know if Santa Cruz was around at that time. But I thought all these programs had more an advantage in recruiting than we did. And I wasn't sure if we could win a national championship. And that year, it was our third year because our triangle is one of our main, it's our philosophy on campus at Springfield College. So we called it the triangle team. We cut down like 10 guys and all the guys that had the right core characteristics and values and integrity that we wanted the program to go forth with. And we had a good year and a really good year in terms of we didn't win a lot, but there was some loophole. I think we were like 3-13 and we made the postseason Division III. And ended up winning the Division III EIVA tournament and then qualifying for the national championship. And so we were doing really well, even though we're failing a lot on the scoreboard. And in the win-loss column, we had really good process-oriented guys that were able to handle that and still improve. And we got into a semifinal with Vassar. And Sam Schweisky at Princeton was on the team. And he'll have maybe a little different detail with the score at that timeout. But Vassar had a really great team. They ran a swing offense where, you know, the guy would be in zone five and hit a go, a middle, or a red, depending on what he felt like doing that time. You could never predict where they were going. And it was like the third year their core guys had run that offense, so they got really efficient at it. So it was crazy fast, crazy all over the place. The block was always off balance, and you really had to be on guard. They had some great players, Jesse Lamb from Hawaii, David Payne from Rochester. And we went into game five. This wasn't an early timeout, by the way. I think it was 11-3. We were down 3-11 in game five. Now, Sam will probably say 4-10, but 3-11 sounds a little better, and I want your podcast to be great here. But that was not an early timeout that time. I probably don't know what I was doing. I probably was in shock and just bummed. But I remember that timeout so well because I really loved that team, and our guys had given it their all. I remember looking around the timeout. I could see the solemn look in their faces, and Mark Schlabach was immediately to my right. And he was a great guy. He put his heart out into everything. And I took the back of my knuckles and rubbed his cheek like you would do with your son. And all I could say was that this is not out of the realm of our possibility. Like what we've done all year shows that we're just going to go process-oriented, rally to rally, and we're going to win the next one. But this isn't something that we can't do. This is something we can do. And we end up climbing all the way back to 16-16. And we trapped that set. Great digs, great swings. There's a couple of swings that we had no business getting a kill out of, but someone hit high seam and it bounced around the block like a pinball and hit the floor somehow. But we got the 16-all and our 6-9 middle JJ from Long Island hit a front one who's no problem. No one's around blocking wise. He cut it out of bounds and so on. So we had the 16-16 and JJ has a hitting error, pure hitting error. I was like, whoop, that was a real rough time for a hitting error, bro. But we ended up collecting that back. I think we won like 19-17 in that game five of the semifinal of the national championship. And that was the time I'll never forget. That was the most memorable one. That was a pretty cool moment to see those guys regroup and do that. And we went on to win the national championship the next day. It was the first national championship that we won. And kind of got the whole thing going in with our program in terms of belief and shaping our culture and how we're going to approach things. And how we're going to do things in Springfield. So that was a pretty cool match, pretty cool timeout, pretty cool memory. I just remember those guys looking so sad, and I remember assuring them that it's what's going to happen in terms of this match is not out of the realm of our possibility to be successful in. So it was pretty cool.
Well, since Nils opened the door, any bad timeout stories? Any mistakes?
Yeah. It's kind of the same thing as those pregame speeches. I know when I have a timeout and I didn't do a good job, I'm kind of upset right away. And it was probably one of those matches that just rolled away from us that I didn't have any effect at all. I wasn't influential. I wasn't informative. Probably spoke too fast. No one could hear me and didn't get through and didn't coach the team. That's what I like about coaching so much. You have a group of guys you have to influence it's just different than coaching yourself and being a player, you know? So I probably was just frustrated right away in terms of a match that we weren't playing well. I didn't have a good effect in the timeout, so.
Well, we're not going to end negative, so.
I like that. I can't remember anything to say, Billy. So I'm trying to say, I don't hang on to the negative.
Well, going back to the quote that Nils read at the beginning about your coaching philosophy, I'd love to hear maybe if there's a success story or any kind of action that you saw from a player where the volleyball and lessons they learned in the gym kind of shaped them outside?
Yeah. That's the best, man. We had our alumni back for our national championship match this year, and to have so many guys in the bleachers, they made these shirts up, they all wore together, and that's pretty cool to see them back, and I'm just really proud of who they are as a person right now. We say we graduate on senior night volleyball people, not volleyball players. And sure, this guy that graduated this year comes to mind right away. We actually, in 2005, had a chance to go to the World University Games, Springfield College. We were really the only true team in the tournament in the University Games, which is supposed to be for student athletes, like an Olympics for student athletes under 26-year-olds. But we were probably the only real university team in the tournament. We played the Russian team, and four of their six guys from London were on the team, the starting lineup, so. I think they just registered for a class and then dropped it after the tournament. But this guy, we ended up playing Argentina. Oh, no, sorry, we played Australia in a warm-up match. And this guy played lights out. He was a freshman. He had just finished his freshman year. But he wasn't a true leader on that team. There's a couple of other guys that were more influential that had emerged as a leader that took a lot of bigger role statistically. But those guys weren't on those trips. So they graduated. And we went up to this tournament. We practiced like four times and played Australia and we beat them. And this guy was lights out. And after that game, I remember being in the Olympic Village or the dorm rooms and saying, "You understand now if you're going to be our best player, that you're going to have to be a lot more responsible. Like you have to be a lot better person, more responsible person. We're going to have to rely on you. We need to come through." And so that was the end of his freshman year. His sophomore year, that didn't happen. He was still irresponsible. His junior year, ineligible. So we're playing on our best player being there. He's not eligible. He didn't pass classes. So that wasn't a good case of being responsible. And even the next year he came back, he wasn't responsible. And this year was his fourth year of eligibility in 5 years at Springfield. And it was like in the fall when we have tryouts, we have 18 shirts and a guy would make team and get a shirt. And so we had like 22 guys. And to be the first guy to get a shirt is pretty special in our gym. You have to do something really, really special. And this guy just changed this year. This guy just figured it out this year. He just figured out how to be more responsible, to communicate better, to live up to expectations, to be dependable, to influence others because he's taking care of himself so well, to influence others so well, and still be our best player. Because that's kind of like the best case scenario, that your best player is your most responsible dude or the guy with the most character that you depend on the most. And so he hadn't even come close to filling that role in his previous 3 years of playing. And he was phenomenal this year. So he finished his career. He's the first guy to get a college degree in either side of his family, his mom's family or his dad's family. He finished with the semester in the spring with his highest GPA of his career. He was like a captain on our team. He was our best player. And he was just so responsible all year. He was a really great leader. So I think right now he's prepared through that experience of learning how to be responsible and be dependable and kind of make the right decisions in certain situations, like you would do in a hitting situation. You want to drive the minivan or the Ferrari. Sometimes better to drive the minivan. He kind of gets the situation better. And I think he's just more prepared for life. And that's what he says now, that he's more prepared for anything that comes up in life because of his experience through our program, which is pretty awesome.
That's awesome, Charlie. That's the questions that we have. Thank you for the time. Thanks for coming on. It's great to catch up with you, and maybe someday we'll run it back and pick your brain about culture too, because I know that's rocking and rolling at Springfield.
That's cool. I hope to
get you on for that. But
awesome, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, guys. Nice talking to you. See ya.